I want to take up in volume 3 from February the 20th, 1900, and here the subject is light. My good Jesus continues to come, Louisa says. After I received communion, he renewed in me the pains of the crucifixion, and I was left so numb that I felt the need for a relief, but I didn't dare ask for it. After what she'd been told a few messages earlier. After a little while, Jesus came back as an infant, as a baby, and he blessed me. Milk flowed from his lips and I drank in large gulps that most sweet milk that comes from his lips. Now, we need to remember that when Jesus comes as an infant, Louise is going to be talking about either receiving milk from him or giving it. And you just need to remember that in the earliest stage of life, that milk represents life itself. So now, while I was doing this, Jesus told me, I am the flower of the celestial Eden, and I am the and the fragrance I spread is such that my perfume perfumes the whole of heaven and keeps heaven captivated. So the flower, I just want to give you one reference for that. You could find others from the Song of Songs, chapter 2 and verse 1. In the Song of Songs, he is the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valley. And since I am the lamp, that is the light of the world, that's John 8, 12 and John 9, 5. Since I am the light that sends light to everyone, so much so as to keep them immersed in it, all of my saints draw their little lights from me. So there's no light in heaven which has not been drawn from this lamp. Now, this is described quite well in Revelation 21, verses 23 to 24, where in the New Jerusalem, where everybody's living in the divine will, there's no need for sunlight or daylight because Christ is our light. And Louisa says, ah, yes, there's not even the smell of virtue without Jesus. And even if one went up to the highest heaven, there's no light without him. So he's the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. That's Revelation 1, 17 to 18. Now we go on to February the 21st, 1900, and the subject is purity. And I want to give you a whole lot of references, and they're not all, indeed. Matthew 5, 8, only the pure in heart see God. Philippians 1, 10, and also chapter 4, verse 8. The first letter of St. Paul to Timothy, chapter 1, verse 5, and chapter 5, verse 22. And the letter to Titus, chapter 1, verse 15. And Hebrews 10, 22. That's just to get you going on this subject. This morning, my beloved Jesus began to make his usual delays. May he always be blessed, for he always starts from the beginning. Indeed, it takes the patience of a saint to bear with him. I just find this absolutely unbelievable. And one would have to deal with Jesus to see how much patience it takes. One who has not experienced it cannot believe it. And it's almost impossible not to have a few huffs with him. I think her language is absolutely fantastic because it's revealing such a close relationship with Jesus that it's telling all the rest of us that this relationship is real. This is not just mystical, as in up in the air and no contact with reality. This is very real. And they are both relating in a very real way to each other. And Louisa thought she had solved the privation problem, and then she finds that Jesus disappears again. And that's what she means by, oh, we're back at the beginning, we're at the start again. And it's very difficult to have patience with him. That's because we're halfway through volume 3 and she has not yet learned. He's told her in plain language that she's to take it with patience. She's to surrender to the divine will. She's to offer it for love of him, and so on and so on. That's okay if you're not going through the pain that she's going through and confined to a bed with absolutely no distraction. So, the heading of the next paragraph is suffering for love of Jesus. It's the only acceptable motivation. Why? Because God is love. Then Louisa said, after being patient in waiting and waiting for him, finally he came and he told me, my daughter, the gift of purity, in other words, he doesn't deal with the privation, he's probably tired of it. My daughter, the gift of purity is not a natural gift. It's an attained grace. And it's obtained by rendering oneself worthy of sympathy, which I think is very interesting. I wouldn't have thought of this in 2 million years. The soul becomes worthy of sympathy through mortification and suffering. Oh, how worthy of sympathy becomes the mortified and suffering soul. How striking she is. And I feel such sympathy as to go mad for her. And whatever she wants, I give her. When you are deprived of me, I'm going to add the words, would you please suffer my privation for love of me, which is the most painful suffering for you, and I will feel more sympathy than before and grant you new gifts. So if only you would accept it, if only you would surrender to the fact that this is going to happen, and if only you would offer it for love of Jesus, then things can move on. Now, she'll take one step forward and three steps backwards, just like we do on things we find difficult. So, February the 23rd, 1900, the subject is discernment. This morning, after I had almost lost the hope that blessed Jesus would come, all of a sudden he came and renewed in me the pains of the crucifixion. And he told me, the time has come, the end is approaching, but the hour is uncertain. So I want to give you Amos 3:7, that the Lord never does anything without telling the prophets first. I also want to give you Revelation 11:1, when we're told the time has come. Okay. Now, this is the beginning of the 20th century, and Jesus is saying it's the end times. Now, lots of commentators around the world have caught on to the fact that we are in end time eschatology, and it's end time events that are happening around us. And the amount of chastisements that have happened on the earth is just off the Richter scale. But we still don't get the message that if we repented, things would change. So having been told that the time has come, the end is approaching and that the hour is uncertain, Louisa said, without paying attention to the meaning of the words that he spoke, I still had a doubt about whether I should apply them to the complete crucifixion that she's just experienced or to the chastisements. And so she said to Jesus, Lord, how I fear that my state may not be the will of God. And she's been at this for 3 volumes, and get used to it and get patient about it. It's going to go on. She does continuous discernment about this. She's right. The road she was on was different to everybody else. And while there were priests there, they could listen and offer their responses, but they couldn't tell her where she was going. Jesus said, the surest sign to know whether the state you are in is in the divine will is that you find the strength to sustain it. So you have the strength to do something. You may be suffering, it may cost you an awful lot, but if you have the strength and the stamina to do it and the certainty in the depths of your being that that's what you're called to, then it is the divine will. And Jesus said, when a person becomes intimate with the family, one no longer uses those formalities, those regards which they used before, even when they were a stranger. That's the way I do it. But nevertheless, this is not a sign that it's not the will of the family to have the person with them or that they no longer love them as before. It's just that circumstances have changed. Therefore, he said, be at peace. let me do, and he's going to plead with her so often to let him have his way. Do not want to rack your brains or trouble the peace of your heart. Now, the thing that was going to bring the, one of the things that was going to bring the 20th century down was rationalism. We want to rationalize everything. We want to bring all reality down within the confines of our tiny little brains. And if they don't fit within the confines of our little brains, we don't accept it. Therefore, truth and mystery and God and creation and life and everything is beyond us, because it's all part of this extraordinary mystery. So he begs her not to rationalize and not to trouble the peace of her heart. So I want to give you Psalm 131 there. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. At the appropriate time, you will understand how I'm working. Now, it's not really until you get to the higher volumes that Louisa becomes not only fully aware of what he's doing, but realizes the plan that he's doing. And she becomes a completely different person at that stage. But what he does between now and then is that he explains everything little by little to her. And he's explaining it little by little to us. So I'm not going to jump ahead and tell you something ahead of volume three. It wouldn't be right. Because we can only take things piece by piece according to the grace that's been given to us. So February the 24th, 1900, the subject is obedience. And the Lord has demanded that Louisa be the obedient one like himself. But this time she's having a problem. This morning I was all fear. Now, we have to know that fear is the greatest weapon of the enemy. And if fear gets into us, he can produce all kinds of problems. I believed that everything was fantasy, she said. That is, the devil wanting to deceive me. So whatever I would see, I would despise and I would be displeased. I saw the confessor placing the intention that Jesus would renew in me the pains of the crucifixion, and I tried to resist. At first, blessed Jesus tolerated me, but since the confessor kept repeating the request, Jesus told me, my daughter, this time we are really going to fail in obedience. Don't you know that obedience must seal your soul? And that obedience must render the soul like soft wax in such a way that the confessor may give to it the shape he wants. Now, even though she's at this very high level of union with God and she has been gifted and graced to such an extraordinary degree, that doesn't mean that your will isn't completely free and that your emotions aren't free to express themselves. OK, and so the Lord is saying to her, I need a deeper surrender. The surrender like melted wax has, that you can put it into any shape at all. So you'll find as we go on in the volumes that Louisa is tested at the absolute extreme of obedience. It's one thing to call it heroism, but she's actually brought to the extreme where a human being can't go. So, heedless of my resistance, Louisa says, Jesus shared with me the pains of the crucifixion. And what you have there is that both God and Satan recognize the authority that a priest has. In exorcisms, Satan will obey a command of a priest and he won't obey a layman. In an exorcism, I don't mean a deliverance. Deliverance is a lesser thing. An exorcism is on the level of miracle. And the devil will respond to a priest who has proper authority from God. Do you remember in the Acts of the Apostles, the sons of Sceva were acting as exorcists and they started trying to get the devil out of people by saying, I command you by the Jesus whom Paul serves. And the devil attacked them and said, what right do you have to command me? Paul is appointed by Jesus. You're not. You don't even believe in him. You just think you can use this yourselves. And the devil's just attacked them. So here you have Jesus giving the crucifixion to Louisa because of the authority that's in the priest. He recognizes it and responds to it. So Louisa said, I wasn't able to resist after this. And I didn't want to for fear that it might not be Jesus. I'll say exactly what she says. And I, no longer able to resist all this, which I did not want for fear that it might not be Jesus, I was forced to succumb under the weight of the pain. May he be always blessed, and may everything be for his glory in everything and always. So I want to give you Ephesians chapter 3, verses 20 and 21. And now we come to a very important moment in volume 3. It's February the 26th, 1900. And this is the very first deep teaching on divine will in these volumes. After going through several days of privation, at most Jesus would come sometimes like a shadow and would run away. I felt such pain that I consumed myself with tears. Now, in higher volumes, the tears will be completely gone. She won't even remember them. Having compassion for my sorrow, blessed Jesus came, and he looked and looked at me again. And he said to me, my daughter, do not fear, for I do not leave you. That's the book of Joshua, chapter 1, verse 5. And 1 Corinthians 3:16, know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? However, when you are without my felt presence, is what you would have to say, I do not want you to lose heart, but rather from today onwards, when you are deprived of me, see, this is why I only want to give you the deprivation bit by bit. Let us get it the way Louisa got it. When you are deprived of me, I want you to take my divine will. I want you to delight in my will. I want you to love me and glorify me in my will. And holding my will as if it was my very person, which it is. The divine will is the essence of God. By doing so, you will help me in your own hands. You'll have me in your own hands, and you can keep me there. So this is a wonderful thing that he's telling her. Now he says, what is it that forms the beatitude of paradise? What is it that makes heaven happy? He said, certainly it's my divinity. Now, what would form the beatitude of my dear ones on the earth? With certainty, he said, my will. My will can never escape you. Now, as we go on in the volumes, he will explain that the divine will is in everything. It's in every tree, every shrub, every animal, every stone, every planet, every molecule of the air, water, etc. It's in every molecule of us. Otherwise, we would not exist. And if he took his will away from us, we would just simply cease to exist. So he said, you'll always have the divine will in your possession. And if you remain within the circle of my divine will, now that circle we're going to hear more and more about as we go on, because it's the infinite dimension of God. And if you remain within the circle of my will, there you will experience joys most ineffable and pleasures most pure. Now that's expressed in Psalm 36, and it's 9 to 10 or 9 to 12, something like that, that we drink from the torrents of his delight. By never going out of the circle of my will, the soul becomes noble. She becomes divinized, and all of her works and workings reverberate in the center of the divine sun. That is sun with a capital S. You're not talking about the planet. Just as the sun's rays, that's now you're talking about the planet, reverberate on the surface of the earth, not one of them goes out of their centre, which is God. You see, the divine will is there. The soul who does my will, that means lives in the divine will, is alone the noble queen who nourishes herself from my breath. Now, the breath of God is Ruach Adonai. That is the Holy Spirit. R-U-A-C-H, Ruach, A-D-O-N-A-I. Ruach Adonai, the breath of God. So, the soul who does my will is alone the noble queen who nourishes herself from my breath, because she takes her food and drinks from no place but my will. And by nourishing herself from my will, which is all holy, a most pure blood will flow in her veins, and her breath will spread a fragrant perfume which will cheer the whole of me, because it is produced in my own breath. Isn't that incredible? Therefore, I want nothing else from you but that you form your beatitude in the circle of my divine will, without ever going out of it, not even for a brief instant. Now, while Jesus was saying this, Louisa said, I felt alarm and fear in my interior, that this message of Jesus might indicate that he was not going to come and that I was going to have to find peace in his will only. I think that's hilariously funny. She would have the whole of him. He's just explained it. But as far as Louisa is concerned, if I can't see you and feel you and all the rest of it, then I don't have you. It's really fantastic. I want to give you Psalm 27, verse 9. It shows you the level at which this woman is in love. Oh, she said, what grips in my heart. But Jesus, who is always good, added, how can I leave you since you are a victim soul? This is the privilege of victim souls, to have the Lord with them. When you cease to be a victim soul, then I will not come. But as long as you are a victim soul, I will always come. I will always come. So I want to give you John 14, 18 there. So it seems, Louisa said, I have remained at peace. But I feel as though surrounded by the adorable will of God in such a way that I find no opening through which to go out. I want to give you John 14, 27 there. Now, you see, the circle of the divine will is infinite. So if she perceives herself in it, naturally, there's no way out. It's a bit like a tiny fish in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean being asked, are there any lands around the place? The little fish doesn't know what a land is. It only knows what water is and this watery environment that is its life. And so Louisa said, I find no opening through which to go out. I hope he will always keep me in this circle that connects me completely to God. Now, we're only on volume 3. Louisa is already lifted up to live in the divine will. That means to operate completely on a divine level. Now, Jesus is not going to confirm this to her until we're up in volume 11 or 12. And the reason is that he wants her to become more and more stable in this before he will alert her to it. But he has given her the teaching, which is really fascinating. And it's just that this, what he's saying to her is so new that the priests don't grasp it. And therefore, they don't ask her lots of questions. And because they don't ask her lots of questions, she doesn't ask lots of questions either. So February the 27th, 1900. The divine will binds Jesus to the soul. Having abandoned all of myself in the lovable will of our Lord. Now, later on, when we get to more teaching on the divine will, we're going to understand that this abandonment means you fuse yourself in the divine will. I saw myself surrounded completely by my sweet Jesus, inside and out. because the same will is now operating in Louisa as is operating in Jesus. So he is in the center of Louisa and Louisa is in the center of him. By having abandoned myself in him, I saw myself as if my being had become transparent. Now, transparent means spiritualized. And that is the process of living deeper and deeper and deeper in the divine will, that our souls become spiritualized, then gradually our minds, and finally even the body. So I want to give you John 3:21 there and Galatians 2:20. I no longer live, Christ lives in me. And wherever I turned, I could see my highest good. Now, this has been her problem. I can't see him. Now she realizes that inside in the divine will, of course she sees him. But that which amazed me was that while I saw myself surrounded by Jesus inside and out, so was I, my poor being, my will, surrounding Jesus as though within a circle. So there you have Louisa in the circle, and which is Jesus, and Jesus in the circle, which is Louisa. It's amazing. So I want to give you John 6:56 and John 14:21, you in me and I in you. So was I, my poor being, my will, surrounding Jesus as though within a circle, in such a way that he would not be able to find an opening to go out, that he wouldn't be able to find it. Okay, not only could she not find her way out, he couldn't either, because this is union. They've become one. Because my will, united to his, kept him chained without any possibility that he might escape. O admirable secret of the will of my Lord, indescribable is your happiness, she said, because she now knows that she's having an earthly experience that the blessed have in heaven all the time. Now, while I was in this state, blessed Jesus told me, my daughter, in the soul who is completely transformed in my will, I find sweet rest. So if you have your book open and you are reading it with me, I want you to put a big line or a colour on completely transformed. Because some people allow themselves to be a little transformed. They don't allow the 100% bit. Her soul becomes for me, Jesus said, like those soft objects which cause no bother to someone who wants to rest. On the contrary, be they even tired and suffering people, the softness and the pleasure they give in resting over those objects is such that when they wake up, they find themselves strong and healthy. Such it is for me, the soul who is conformed to my will. I want to give you Romans 8:28 there. And I, as recompense, allow myself to be bound by her will, and I make the divine sun shine in her as in full midday. There's nothing blocking the light from coming through. Hence, she noticed herself transparent. Now, in higher volumes, she will actually acknowledge what Jesus tells her, that her soul has become like crystal, and crystal allows light completely through. So having said this, Jesus disappeared. Now we have a different subject. God hates us complaining. We don't like people complaining either. But to complain behind people's back and turn it into gossip is even worse, and it's condemned by the Bible. Then later, after I received communion, Jesus came back and transported me outside of myself. I could see many people, and Jesus told me, tell them, that it is a great evil that they do by murmuring against one another and about one another. So he's including gossip there as well. And if you have the book of Proverbs, there's plenty in it about gossip. He says, they draw my indignation and with justice, because I see that while they are subject to the same miseries and weaknesses, They do nothing but raise tribunals against one another. So that's Christians taking Christians to court. And Jesus says, none of them are any better than anybody else. They all have the same problems. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 6, verses 1 to 11, where St. Paul tells the Corinthians that it is a contradiction in terms that Christians would take one another to court. And then Jesus said, if they do this among themselves, what should I, who am pure and holy, do with them? According to the charity with which they exercise towards one another, do I feel drawn to use mercy with them? Now, first of all, I want to give you Matthew 7, 1 to 5. Do not criticize, do not condemn, if you don't want to be condemned by our just and holy God. So now he's saying that the amount of compassion and understanding and mercy that he feels drawn to give us is the amount that we give to others. But he did give us the golden rule that to do unto others what we would like others to do unto us. And he did order us in John 13, verses 34 to 35, that we're to love one another in the same way as he loved us, which is sacrificially and with forgiveness and big-heartedness. Okay. And in John 15, 9, Jesus says, as the Father loves me, that's the way I love you. That means unconditionally, absolutely, eternally, with forgiveness, knowing your weaknesses, and that's the way you're to love one another as well. So Jesus was saying this to me, Louisa said, and I repeated it to those people, and then we withdrew. So March the 2nd, 1900, we talk about union with Jesus. This morning, after I received Holy Communion, my sweet Jesus made himself seen crucified. And I felt drawn interiorly to reflect myself in him, to be able to become like him. That's 2 Corinthians 3:18. And Jesus reflected himself in me to draw me into his likeness. While doing this, I felt the pains of my crucified Lord being infused into me. And with all goodness, he told me, I want suffering to be your nourishment. Now, he's talking to her as a victim soul. It's not exactly the same with the rest of us. And I want suffering to be your nourishment, not only as suffering, but as the fruit of the divine will. The most sincere kiss which binds our friendship more tightly is the union of our wills. The Song of Songs 1:1. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Now, Louisa often got kisses from Jesus, but St. Bernard of Clairvaux did about 12 sermons on let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. And he warned people like me to be very careful about asking the Lord for this, because we're much further back now than people like Louisa. And he said that we have to learn, first of all, to kiss his feet in repentance, as Mary of Magdala did. And then we gradually, as we grow, we reach his knees and we kiss his hands as good disciples. And then as we grow even more, we can kiss his heart, as John did at the Last Supper. And he may or may not ever give us the kisses of his mouth, because if you get it, you will get the gall that was in his mouth. You will get the terrible, bitter breath that was inside of him. You will get all his crucifixion. And usually the victim souls are the ones who say yes much more quickly than the rest of us. Some of the rest of us never get there. So just to clarify, when we use language like this. So Jesus says the most sincere kiss which binds our friendship more tightly is the union of our wills, and the indissoluble bond that will clasp us in continuous embraces will be the continuous suffering. So there's the victim soul identifying completely with the crucified. So while Jesus was saying this, he unnailed himself, took his cross and laid it in the interior of my body, Louisa said. And I too was so stretched as to feel my bones being dislocated, which she describes in the hours of the Passion happened to Jesus as they were nailing him. Moreover, a hand, but I cannot tell with certainty whose it was, pierced my hands and feet through. Jesus, who was seated on the cross which lay in my interior, was all pleased with my suffering and with the one who was piercing my hands. And he added, "Now I can rest in tranquility. I do not even have to take the trouble of to crucify you, because obedience wants to do it herself." That means that hand is the intention of the priest. "And I leave you freely in the hands of obedience." And moving quickly upon the cross, he placed himself upon my heart to rest. Now, when Jesus finds rest in us, it means that we have taken upon ourselves to make reparation and substitution for others so that souls will be saved. The only relief we can give Jesus is to give him souls. "Who can say how much suffering I remained in," Louisa said, "being in that position? After I remained like this for a long time, Jesus would not bother relieving me as at other times so as to let me return to my natural state." Why? Because he has abandoned her into the arms of the priest, and the priest won't even know what's going on. "I could no longer see that hand which put me on the cross, and I said this to Jesus, and he replied, 'Well, who put you on the cross? Did I perhaps do it?' It was obedience," that's the priest. "And obedience must remove it." So Louise is going to have to talk a bit more to the priests now. "It seems that this time," Louisa said, "he wanted to play. And by his highest grace, I obtained that Jesus would set me free." So Louisa pushed the button strong enough for Jesus to actually do it one more time to set her free. But what Louisa doesn't realise right now is that what is happening to her is a preparation for the future in which the priest will have a much stronger role than he has now. And therefore that Jesus won't be doing work that really somebody else should be doing. So March the 7th, 1900. This is union with the divine will. "This morning, finding myself outside of myself, I had to go round and round to find my blessed Jesus." Round and round for Louisa means through heaven and earth, in and out of the body experience. "Fortunately, I entered into a church and I found him on the altar where the divine sacrifice was being celebrated. Immediately, I ran to him and I embraced him, telling him, 'Finally, I have found you. You made me go round so much to the point of tiring myself, and you were here.' And Jesus, looking at me with seriousness, not with the usual kindness, told me, 'This morning I feel very embittered, and I feel the full need to lay hand on chastisements to free myself of this load.' And Louisa said immediately, 'My dear,'" I love the way she calls Jesus, "my dear. My dear, it's nothing. We will remedy it quickly." Now, the "we" is Philippians 4:13. "I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength." I also want to give you Psalm 106, verse 23, that Louisa is willing to stand in the breach to save the people. And Isaiah 58:12, that it's a terrible thing if there's nobody who can stand in the breach. So Louisa steps up to the plate. She said, "We'll remedy this. You will pour your bitterness into me, and so you will be relieved of the load. Isn't that right?" And he, complying with my words, poured his bitterness into me. Then afterwards, clasping all of me to himself, as if he had freed himself of a heavy weight, he said, "The soul who is conformed to my will knows how to infiltrate herself so much into my power as to reach the point of binding me completely." In other words, this level of communion with God in the divine will and this level of identification with Jesus in his sufferings gives the soul a power that is divine. It's really incredible. She can reach the point of binding me completely, Jesus said, and to her liking, she disarms me as she wants. Ah, you, he said, how many times you bind me. And while saying this, he assumed his usual sweet and benign appearance. So you're talking here about prayer combined with sacrifice. So March the 9th, 1900, we're back to talking about grace. As I was a little disturbed, now we know from volume one, you're not allowed to be disturbed. Jesus doesn't want any disturbance in your interior because your interior is the Holy of Holies where he wants to dwell. And if there is disturbance in it, it opens it up to attack from the evil one. So he told us right from the very beginning in volume one to make absolutely certain that nothing gets into your innermost being. So she said, I was a little disturbed because of something which is not necessary to say here. My mind wanted to go wandering about so as to be assured about my disturbance and so remain in peace. But blessed Jesus, wanting to contradict my will, prevented me from seeing what I wanted. And since I insisted in wanting to see, he told me, why do you want to go wandering about? Don't you know that one who goes out of my will goes out of the light and confines herself in darkness? And almost wanting to distract me from what I wanted, he transported me outside of myself. Okay, let's stop there for a moment. Jesus deliberately contradicted Louise's will. You've heard me saying before that the moment we enter into this path, we have to take it as our daily motto, not my will, but thine be done, O Lord. And he will allow people to contradict you. He will allow events to upset you insofar as it's cutting across your plans. And we have to learn to ride with this and each time take it as an opportunity, saying, Lord, what you're looking for is the gift of my will and I give it to you. You're in control of everything. Now, if we do this from the beginning, we will make huge strides. If we don't, we won't get anywhere. So I pick up with Louisa again, and almost wanting to distract me from what I wanted, she said, he transported me outside of myself, and changing the subject, he said, take a look at how ungrateful human beings are to me. Now, throughout the 36 volumes, the human race is identified as completely ungrateful. With the crisis that's in the country and the church at the moment, you'd have to agree. People don't say yes, please, thank you, sorry anymore. They've just dropped it. Because if you drop religion, you also drop civilization. It is religion that brought civilization to Europe. And we're becoming more and more uncivilized. So he said, take a look at how ungrateful human beings are to me. The light of the sun fills the whole earth, from one end to the other, in such a way that there's no land which does not enjoy the benefit of its light. There's no one who can complain about being without its beneficial influence. In fact, investing the whole universe, the sun takes it as though in hand to be able to give light to everything. Only one who, escaping from its hand, goes to hide in dark places can complain of not enjoying its light. And yet, continuing its charitable office, the sun does not cease to send him a few glimmers of light through its fingers. I love that. You pull down the shutters and the light gets around them. You pull the curtains across and the light manages to find little places to come through. And in the same way, for people who are resisting God and living in sin, he will get through, he'll get to you and give you the opportunity to come back to him. So he said, this is what my grace is like. The sun is an image of this, which my grace inundates people everywhere, the poor and the rich, the ignorant and the learned, Christians and unbelievers. That's terribly important. John 10:10, other sheep I have, that do not belong to this fold, and them also I must bring. No one can say that he or she is without grace, because the light of truth and the influence of my grace fill the earth, more than the sun fills the earth with light at midday. So I want to give you Acts 17:28. But what pain I have in seeing people who, passing through this light with their eyes closed and confronting my grace with the pestilent torrent of their iniquities. That is strong language. They deviate from the light and they live voluntarily in dark places, in the midst of the most cruel spiritual enemies. So I want to give you John 3:19-21, where Jesus says that some people reject the light and choose the darkness. It's an awful mystery, because the terrifying gift that God has given to us is free will. And we can say no, and we can stay that way if we decide. So we also use the expression, there are none so blind as those who refuse to see. So these people are exposed to 1,000 dangers because, not having light, which of course is the presence of God in us, they cannot know clearly whether they are in the midst of friends or enemies, and therefore shun the dangers that surround them. If the sun had reason and human beings were able to give this affront to its light, and some of them, in order to irritate the light and not to see it, would show such ingratitude as to pluck their eyes out to be more sure of living in darkness. And instead of sending light, the sun would send laments and cries of sorrow, such as to turn all nature upside down. So crazy. Yet that which one would have horror in doing to natural light, they reach such excess as to do to my grace, treating it in this way. But my grace is always kind to them. And in the midst of darkness itself and of the madness of their blindness, it always sends glimmers of light. Because my grace never leaves anyone. And we know from volume 2 that God is grace. It is man who voluntarily goes out of grace. And grace, not having him within itself, tries to follow him with glimmers of light. Well, Jesus tried to get through to us on this subject in the wonderful parable of the prodigal son and the parable of the lost son. And of course, it's the human race that is the prodigal son, always wallowing in the lowest activities when they were called to be eagles flying high in God's sky. While saying this, Jesus was extremely afflicted, and I did as much as I could to console him, praying him to pour his bitterness into me, Louisa said. And he said, bear with me if I am the cause of affliction to you, because once in a while I feel the necessity with my beloved soul to pour out my pain in words for the ingratitude of the human race, so as to move their hearts to repair for such an excess. Now here you've got a very tender moment in which Jesus says, would you bear with me for a while? I actually need to put words onto this. I actually need you to hear in words the sorrow of your God, watching the children that God has given life and grace and everything to, watching them destroy themselves. And perhaps if you hear my words, you might actually turn and make some reparation. He said, I want to move your hearts to repair for such an excess, and I want to move your hearts to compassion for human beings themselves. Because after all, hell is a terrible place to go to. So Louisa said, Lord, what I would like is that you would not spare me the sharing of your pains. And as I tried to say more, he disappeared and I returned to myself. You see, he couldn't give her more pains at that particular point. Human nature can only take so much. So March the 10th, 1900, and the subject here is suffering. This morning, having received Holy Communion, I saw my dear Jesus as a child with a lance in his hand in the act of wanting to pierce my heart through. We have a very famous statue in the Carmelite Church, I think it's in Clarendon Street, showing Teresa of Avila receiving the lance from an angel. And it's given in such, it's shown in such dramatic lines that it's, when I read Louisa, I just say, they've exaggerated. Because God can do something very simply. He doesn't need the terrible drama that was illustrated in the statue. And this is the second time or third time that we've read this, even in volume three. So he had a lance in his hand in the act of wanting to pierce my heart through. And since I had said something to the confessor, wanting to reproach me, Jesus said, "You want to shun suffering, and I want you to begin a new life of sufferings and of obedience." Now, you probably don't guess what the new life is. Louisa didn't either, although she had started it. And that is that she was to suffer on a completely new level, which was a divine level in the divine will. And her obedience was also to shift up onto this new level, the divine level. And therefore, both the obedience and the love with which she obeyed and the sufferings were all going to have an infinitely greater effect on the human race. So while saying this, he pierced my heart with the lance. And then he added, but before we do that, I want to give you Luke 2:35, a sword will pierce your own soul too. And Jesus explained, "Just as the fire burns according to the wood that is placed in it, thus being more active in burning and consuming the objects that are thrown into it, and the greater the fire, the greater the heat and the light that comes from it. The same with suffering and obedience." He's trying to begin to tell her it's going to be a much greater reality at the divine level. So I want to give you Luke 3:16 and Luke 12:49. So he said, it's the same with suffering and obedience. The greater they are, the more the soul becomes capable of destroying what is material. And obedience gives her the shape it wants, like soft wax. Now, he's been talking about that for a while, hasn't he? I want to give you Hebrews 12:29. Our God is a consuming fire. Now, fire is one of the great images that's used in the Bible. God is called fire. I've just given you Hebrews 12:29. But God isn't always a consuming fire. Moses met God as fire in the burning bush, but it was not consuming the bush. And the apostles experienced God as fire on Pentecost Day, but the fire didn't consume them. Not in the sense that we understand fire consuming, because when the Holy Spirit, the fire of God, enters into us, he does four things. One, he cleanses. And then he goes much deeper. He purifies. Then he goes, he sanctifies, and then he glorifies. They are the four stages. But fire is also the image of hell. So how can the same fire be the image of heaven and hell? Well, Matthew 3:10-11 actually explains it. So if you just write down CF, that is, you know, compare Matthew 3:10-11, because Matthew says that he who is coming after me will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. Now, that's the fire of love to cleanse and purify and sanctify and glorify us. But he says those who reject this will be thrown on the fire that never goes out. Now, the fire that never goes out is an inert fire. It never cleanses, it never purifies, it never sanctifies, and it never glorifies. And therefore, this is one of the images of hell, that a substance is put into it, it's never ever cleansed. In the, you know, scientists have always used fire to cleanse gold and silver, for example, of any dross that's in them. But gold and silver put on an inert fire, nothing would happen. They would remain tarnished. And so hellfire, while it's terrible and it's burning and it's torturing, it doesn't produce anything. It's utter frustration. So March the 11th, 1900, Louisa encounters a soul in purgatory and responds in a way that utterly amazes me. So it continues the same way, she said. This morning I saw good Jesus more afflicted than usual, threatening a great mortality of people. This is a hint at World War I. And I saw that in certain towns many were dying. And then I passed by purgatory, she said. And as I recognised a late friend of mine, I questioned her about various things regarding my state. Now, this is what amazes me. I thought that when you met the souls in purgatory, you were supposed to be praying for their release. Anything but. Especially, she said, whether my state is the will of God. Now, Louisa keeps this up and she's going to keep it up for about 15 or 16 volumes. And whether it is true that it is Jesus who comes or the devil. And Louisa said, I said to her, since you are in the presence of truth itself and you know things with clarity, with no possibility of deceiving yourself, you can tell me the truth about my affairs. And the soul in purgatory said to her, do not fear, your state is the will of God and Jesus loves you very much. This is why he is pleased to manifest himself to you. And then Louisa said, I started proposing some doubts to her, prayed her to be so kind as to see before the light of truth whether they were true or false, and to do me the charity. I thought it was supposed to be the other way around, that we did charity to the souls in purgatory, but never mind. And to do me the charity to come and let me know. And then Louisa said, and if she did that, as recompense, I would have a mass celebrated for her suffrage. Well, I thought you would do that anyway, without making her pay for it, you know. And the soul responded, if the Lord wants it, because we are so immersed in God that we cannot even flutter our eyelashes if we do not have his concourse, his agreement. We dwell in God, just like a person who dwelled in another body, who can think, speak, look, work, walk insofar as is allowed to him by that body which surrounds him. So it's a bit like a hand in a glove in a way. So what happens is that Louisa gets an extraordinary revelation from this soul. I mean, it's amazing to me. We normally have the image of the souls only in fire. We forget, you see, that the fire of love is God. And here this soul is saying that we are completely immersed in God and there's not a thing we can do without God absolutely agreeing to it. So obviously God agreed to that soul talking to Louisa or it wouldn't have happened. So we dwell in God just like a person who dwelled in another body, who can think and speak and look and work and walk insofar as it is allowed to him by that body which surrounds him on the outside. Now, here's an image of the souls in purgatory completely inside the circle of the divine will. And until they are purified, their experience of being in touch with the holiness of God is painful. And when the purification is over, then the painful aspect of it disappears and they move into the glorious and celebratory part of God's love. It's just a new image of purgatory, isn't it? So the soul said, in fact, for us, it's not like for you. You can exercise your free will. For us, every will has ceased. Our will is only the will of God. And from it we live, in it we find our contentment, and the will of God forms all our good and our glory. And as she was showing an unspeakable contentment, talking about the will of God, We separated, Louisa said. Now, I think this is a most wonderful, wonderful picture of the souls in purgatory that's very different to most people's image of them. I think it deserves to be read over and over again. And I'll just give you a little illustration. It's probably a million miles away from the reality that they're experiencing, but then I've never been to purgatory. If you've ever been in the presence of a very holy person, now I don't just mean the physical presence as in you stand beside them for 5 minutes, but if you have to deal with a very holy person, their holiness shows up your unholiness. They're not doing anything about it. They're just being themselves. Their love shows up your unlove. Their sacrificial way of doing things shows up your selfishness. And so your experience of being in that presence is uncomfortable and challenging. And that's the description that's given to us here of the souls in purgatory, that their experience of brushing up against this divine love is uncomfortable and challenging and painful, but gradually, gradually, gradually they mold into it and they become like that which they worship. I'm going to stop there for a while.